Welcome, everyone, to the International MD Support Group's first session of 2011. We're entering our sixth year, I believe, of this project, and we're just having a great time with some wonderful presenters lined up for this coming year. I'm Dan Roberts, along with Dr. Ed Huggett, and our guest presenters this month are Dr. Tracy Williams and Leah Gerlach from the Spectrios Institute for Low Vision. Dr. Williams is an optometrist and low vision specialist. He's a frequent national and international lecturer in the field of low vision rehabilitation and also participates in annual mission trips to third world countries. He's well known for his comprehensive head, heart, and eyes approach to low vision rehabilitation for people with vision loss. Since 1986, Dr. Williams has served as the executive director of the Dyke Center for Visual Rehabilitation in Illinois, a nationally accredited, not-for-profit agency that provides low vision rehabilitation. He's currently a clinical associate professor at Loyola University and chairman of the American Optometric Association's Low Vision Rehabilitation Section Executive Committee. Dr. Williams is a board member and a vice chairman of the National Accreditation Council for agencies serving the visually impaired and blind. He's also a member of Joint Commission of Allied Health Professionals in Ophthalmology, Low Vision Task Force, as well as having an appointment with the National Eye Institute and the National Eye Health Educational Program as co-chair of the Low Vision Committee. He's a very busy man, obviously. He's become a very good friend of mine as we've worked on committees together, and we've had some very good talks about low vision rehabilitation, and I'm very happy that he's here with us today, along with Leah, who is his partner there at the what we used to call the Dyke Center, but I think he's going to explain a little bit more about that to us. Welcome, Dr. Williams, and would you please introduce your co-presenter to us?
Hi, Dan. It's a real pleasure being with you, and I've admired your wonderful mission, and Leah and I are so happy to be the first ones for you in 2011. I want to thank you for that long introduction. Some of those kind things you said are sort of in the past, but just to bring you up to the future here, I have a star sitting next to me by the name of Leah Gerlach, and she and I both have been working at now our place is called the Spectrios Institute for Low Vision, but it's still at the Dyke House. Leah has had vision loss ever since she was born. She has retinopathy of prematurity. Despite her vision loss, she accomplishes things that just amaze and dazzle us every single year and a day. She has her master's in rehabilitation counseling. She's certified in adaptive and assistive technology. She's been a tremendous role model and mentor, not only to the many patients that we work with, but also to our staff and other professionals. So, Leah, why don't you say hi to the gang here, and if you want to add anything to that.
Well, thank you for the very nice introduction. I've been working at Spectrios Institute for the last 25 years, and have held quite a number of positions here. We believe very strongly in the concept of the head, the heart, and the eyes, and helping people learn how to adjust to life with a vision loss and the potential that they have for just about anything they want to do.
Okay, Dan, I think I'll throw it back to you.
All right. I have visited the Dyke Center, the Dyke House. It's a beautiful setup there, everybody. I wish I could clone Dr. Tracy Williams and his staff and all of the facilities they have up there in Wheaton, Illinois, and put one in every one of our towns. You're going to hear a little bit more about how they operate, and that's really the model for low vision rehabilitation as far as I'm concerned as one of the patients. The head, heart, and eyes approach, I think, is something that we all need to hear, that there are doctors out there who are thinking this direction, that we are more than just our eyeballs. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today. And I think, let's start, Dr. Williams, from your perspective, what are the elements that lead to successful low vision rehabilitation outcomes for us?
Well, Once again, I think the thing that I learned at a very early stage in my professional career, and a lot of times not just working with extremely gifted low vision rehabilitation practitioners, but working with people who had vision loss, was how important it is to work truly on the head, heart, and eyes. And I think especially when you think of the two sides of the fence, one side of the fence is the medical side, where, of course, you find out what's my definitive diagnosis, what's the etiology or caused this problem to happen, and what is my future, what is my prognosis. But if a person indeed has a permanent vision loss, the next step is low vision rehabilitation. If there's any vision that they can possibly maximize, that's the next bridge that they have to cross. And I think what's different in the rehabilitation model is, number one, we have perhaps more time to work with the person and try to give as much education as we possibly can. Number two, we are going to try every possible effort to maximize the vision and any other abilities that that person has. And finally, to motivate and get the individual not to be the victim of the vision loss, but to hopefully be the goodwill ambassador. So I think those are the things. Leah, would there be anything else you might like to add?
I'd like to just say that in a comprehensive program, the concept of finding out who the person is, where they are emotionally, knowledge-wise, psychologically, and help them come up with realistic expectations and understand that there is potential for doing the things that they've oftentimes given up, is a very powerful tool in helping them accept devices and training in the rehabilitation process.
You know, I think too, Dan, that you are very, very lucky if you can find the way to afford a model where you can have a multidisciplinary team approach, where you can actually get people that have the credentials. And we're very, very blessed that about a third of our staff have vision loss as well. So it just makes it a very nice house of hope. It's a very fun place, I think. If you looked at our staff, you'd find out that many of us have been here, Leah, for, oh my gosh, I mean, you
a century.
Yeah. But I think of our 15 staff, I would think that at least, I don't know, the fewest amount of time that one of our staff has is
two-thirds of them have been here over 10 years.
Yeah.
Everybody's been here at least five.
So it's great to have the chemistry, too, Dan.
And I'm sure you would both agree that the patient is a big part of that, actually part of the staff, and needs to be educated in these procedures as well, and how to cross that what you call the bridge between vision and low vision, and vision techniques and devices, and low vision and non-visual techniques and devices. Would you agree that the patient is just as much a part of that team as you are?
Leah and I are both nodding here that your center must be a consumer-driven center. I think on one hand, the term that we like to use is professional paternalism, meaning that we, with the training and the books we've read and the experience we have, our job, like a parent, is to share all this experience, to share this knowledge, so that the patient can take ownership of their own individual rehabilitation plan. So you're absolutely, Dan, that's so correct that we are a consumer-driven center.
Okay, I think maybe we ought to go ahead and just start with the head. Do you think we can start at the top and work our way down to the whatever the eyes, I guess? What does the person with vision loss need to know, need to learn, and need to do to relate to maximizing their remaining vision and their other abilities?
Okay, probably the most important thing is to begin with knowledge. When we meet with a patient for the first time, it's very important that we understand what do they know about their eye disease. Fear is a very powerful deterrent to rehabilitation, and fear is often motivated by the lack of knowledge. So giving people knowledge about what their eye disease is, how their eyes work, and that there are strategies and tools and technology that can help them is often the first step. So understanding is a very key, important part of getting a person to begin the journey in vision rehabilitation. So we spend a lot of time teaching, finding out what they know or what they don't know, teaching them about what their eye disease is, how their eyes function, and how rehabilitation actually can help them. Dr. Williams?
Yeah, it's a very powerful thing, I think, if when you come and meet with a doctor too, that the doctor really has a plan to spend some time, hopefully in sort of Andy of Mayberry language, talk about what is wrong with the eyes, but what's also working with those eyes. I think when people realize the parts of their eyes that still function, then maybe like Apollo 13, we can begin to work with the parts we still have to try to be as independent and be able to do quality of life pursuits. I think that also there's sort of a bonding or sort of a friendship and rapport when you have the chance to interchange both the person with the vision loss but the doctor. Each has a chance to talk and each has a chance to listen. And I think that one of the things that's important with me is I really do like to listen to what the person's goals are. Are they a person that really misses a lot of near-point tasks, for example? Or they might be a person that hardly does anything up close. It's all distant types of activities. I think that's a very important thing. And then I think for people with vision loss, they do to some extent, I think, have to have some trust and be willing to learn. And it often reminds me of when my mom sort of forced me to take a summer school typing course. Well, I didn't have the best attitude to really do that at first. And I think from an expectation standpoint, my mom, who types 100 words a minute or so, if she expected me to type 25 words a minute in that first week, that expectation would be a little bit too high. I'd have to learn the home row, I think, for a week or two. But the bottom line is there's learning curves. And so I think a person does come into this not just expecting a simple pair of glasses, but expecting a good experience, an experience that you learn and grow. And this is not a quick vignette, slam dunk thing. This is an ongoing process and hopefully a really good experience. So I think working on the head is really inviting the person with vision loss to learn as much as they possibly can and hopefully having good teachers surrounding them that are constantly seeing potential in them and trying to lift them as high as they can go.
Excellent. What about the heart? How do you motivate people and help them move forward with their lives despite vision loss? That is one of the most difficult parts of this, is to move forward once we've reached the age of 60 or 70. We feel like, maybe that was supposed to be our goal, and now we find that we have to make a whole new life for ourselves as a low vision person. How do you help motivate people to do that, to energize them?
What's really helped me a great deal, because I'm fortunate, at least to this point, to have good 20/20 vision, but I have to tell you, when I work on a team where my other teammates don't have 20/20 corrected vision, and I sort of learn what their challenges are, I see how they cope, the things that they do, it's so inspirational for me to be able to have even stronger conviction when I'm trying to encourage people that I see every single day. In other words, I think some of the patients that come here, Leah, are thinking, boy, my vision is really terrible and I can't do this and that. And then all of a sudden, Leah, they're greeted by you and your guide dog, Jan. And very quickly, when they sit down and chat with you and you go through their intake, suddenly they probably are saying to themselves, oh, my gosh, look at this lady here. And she's so together. She's employed. She seems to be pretty happy. She's valuable. All these important things. So I think that is one of the key things that's very nice, and that's why Leah runs a great support group as well. I can say that as the doctor component of it, I get back to that saying I said before, being able to see potential in people when maybe no one else can, and that even might be the person with vision loss. When you work in this field like I have, I hate to admit it, about 25 to 30 years now, you have seen so many different lives change. You've seen so many people start at point A and climb the mountain to point B. You realize that people can do so much more, but maybe you're that one authoritative voice that says you can. So I think as far as the heart goes, I think seeing people that are successful, so I think that's a key. Second of all, working with a staff that has realized this and being that sort of tough, loving advocate in the foxhole. In other words, we never want to push anyone too hard. But on the other hand, I have to tell you that I think many of the people that we work with, after a while, when they see our hearts in the right way, a place, and see the directions and the creativity and the tools and on, they go, you know, this isn't so bad. You know, this is. I think I am going to have to gut out some of this. I'm going to have to think about this. If I'm the matriarch or the patriarch of the family, what example am I showing to the rest of the family? I have to think about, you know, how can I be that person that I was before where I was giving? I want to get back into that mode. And if I have to do that by learning and growing and really being concerned about what's my attitude, am I the horse that's led up to water that's going to drink or not? What do you think about that, Leah?
I think the heart is an important part of a person. It speaks to who they are as individuals. I also think that when we start working with someone, we want to find out what their passions are, what their fears are, how their lifestyle has changed, not from the tasks I can't do, but from the area of self-esteem and relationships. The more that we can help people learn to cope with validating their feelings. It's okay to grieve about a vision loss, but it's important to move on. If we can help validate that we understand, a lot of times people need to think about what their passions are. What really, really motivates them? What do they really, really miss doing? And then take that passion of that individual, those feelings, and help them sort the feelings out, help them find their ground. When I talk with patients, I often talk about a sudden vision loss is like getting kicked in the stomach or knocked over. You have to find your feet again. You have to find where your center is and how you are going to then move forward. And moving forward involves, what is the most important thing that I want to try and be able to do? And am I ready to listen, to learn that there is a way that I can do that? Dan, thank you.
Well, I think in summary, Dan, one of the things we also do here is we see about 350 children K through 12th grade. And it is a common thing, especially with our teens, that a lot of them feel that if they have vision loss, they're less of a person. And it's a very common saying or message that we send out there. You aren't defined by your sight. You're defined by your head and heart. And I think that's so true, Dan.
And what I'm hearing at the basis of all this is that you guys, you listen to the patient. You say that a lot, that you listen to the patient. And I know that takes time. You mentioned tools earlier. Many years ago, probably before I met you, you mentioned a toolbox for people with vision loss to seek out the right tools to help them with their vision. Tell me about this approach to working with the eyes, Dr. Williams.
Well, Dan, I think that sometimes if you think of this thought, when you have vision loss, at least in the past, you may have been so fortunate that one pair of glasses did it all. It would help you see at far, arm's length, or up close to read. But as many people with vision loss learn, you need to almost have special tools to match up at the task at hand. If it's a distant task, well, yes, there might be distant conventional lenses that help you see. But then again, you might need to have some form of a telescope. You might have special glasses that have telescopes in the top, or you might have a handheld monocular. Telescopes can be very helpful to help a person spot things better at far. On the other hand, maybe a person is trying to get their reading speed as good as possible. They may be fortunate that they can get stronger reading glasses or a stronger bifocal than they had before, and they learn to hold things closer, favoring their better seeing eye with good lighting coming over the shoulder of the better seeing eye. Or maybe they need a prescription handheld magnifier, or maybe they simply need to get something that can blow the print up or large print text, or perhaps they need adaptive or assistive technology, electronic magnification to help them see. But as you hear me talk, you're hearing several tools. So like an apprentice carpenter who's just starting off, that carpenter may not have all the right tools to build the houses or the other things that he or she needs to accomplish. So I think you have to understand, if you have vision loss, you're probably going to have to learn new strategies, which includes specific tools, specific environmental setup. There's going to be some strategies and thinking and some adaptive training going into making the most out of your sight. But the bottom line is, there seems to always be a solution. There seems to be a way. It just, what again is important is the person's attitude. Well, doctor, if I've got to get the steel out of my arms, I've got to hold things closer, I'll do it. Because you know what? I want to do it myself. Or doctor, and I have to hold it 2 inches in front of my best seeing eye, even though after a while there might be ink constantly on the end of my nose, or my nose might get flat after a while on the tip, that's okay, because I'm independent and I had no chance of seeing before, but with this tool I can see. And as far as reading goes, who cares if you have a gadget, you know, that you have to turn on and you can set it up perfectly and go from there. But let's not also forget, you can get vision from your ears and from your fingertips. And speaking about getting vision from your ears, let me pass this over to Leah.
Okay. Our toolbox can be filled with lots of different kinds of tools. And when we talk about adaptive technology, we may be talking about electronic devices, computer devices, things that most people don't think of when they think about seeing. They're looking for glasses and optical devices. When we have tasks that require endurance, maybe I need to read for 4 hours a day, I might use a video magnifier like a CCTV, or I might use an audible device that will take my document and read it back to me so that I don't have eye fatigue, and I can use my vision for the pictures of my grandkids, which I can't get someone to describe for me, or for other tasks in my daily routine. Technology has leveled the playing field for all of our low vision patients, whether they are mild to moderately visually impaired or very profoundly visually impaired, because computer technology, whether I'm looking at an iPad or an iPhone, or I'm looking at a desktop computer, I can find technology that will either increase the display and make it easier for me to read, run the text along the screen like a ticker tape so that I don't have to move my eyes. I can just watch the ticker move the print in front of me, or screen read to me and tell me what everything is going on the screen, or even allow me, if I have multiple disabilities, to use screen reading software to listen to, but voice recognition software to dictate to. So technology is there for just about everything.
All right. We are fortunate to have Ike Presley coming in October to tell us about all that new technology. So we're looking forward to that. Moving along here, you mentioned that the patient has to, of course, be the driving force in this, but there are also people involved in with that patient and in their lives. So another term I've heard you use in the past is the coach, being present during the low vision rehabilitation experience, meaning the wife or the caregiver. And so would you please elaborate on that concept, Dr. Williams?
Again, I've learned that we see that our success in working with people in the low vision rehabilitation program seems to be greatly enhanced if the individual brings along a significant other. Now, that significant other could be their spouse, it could be their siblings, it could be a good friend. But the bottom line is, having an individual that you love sitting in the room gives you an extra set of ears. It also, whether the person with vision loss realizes this or not, if it's family members, for example, your children, they might be saying in their own minds, will I have to cross this bridge someday myself? And also, sometimes when we talk on the phone with our family or friends and we have vision loss, maybe in this culture they think you're either blind or have 20/20. So if you have a person, a loved one there who can watch what's going on, who can listen to some of the discussions, I think it's shared knowledge that's very powerful, because that loved one is going to be, I think, a dynamic support person, sort of your own support group going home. And so we have found that when we have a coach, so to speak, who's there, we've actually, Leah can talk about this more, but we empower this person, of course, with the blessing of the patient, but we give them a notepad, a pen, and I think it makes it very engaging. I think afterwards, like if they had a morning session with us, when they go out to lunch, a lot of things that may have been said may have not always been captured by each person, but sometimes with a team of two, it gets captured. You know, before, I just wanted to say, we see about 6 to 8 patients a day, and we're pretty tired at the end of the day. So we're seeing one person that would be examined by me, for example, the doctor's time is an hour, and Leah spends about 20 minutes to a half an hour. They also get about 40 minutes with our rehabilitation teacher, and that's just the first visit. The following visit, they might get another 40 minutes with the doctor, maybe another 20 minutes with the counselor, and they get an hour downstairs in our tech center. So you can see there's a lot of assignments here. But, Leah, as far as working with coaches or significant others, what's been your experience?
What I've found through working with coaches come, one, because most everybody that comes here needs a ride. A lot of times they're not sure why they're here, and we have to explain to them that it's that we want them to sit in through the whole process. Sometimes we're teaching them things that they don't know. They don't understand why Grandma can catch something out of the corner of their eye but not identify the grandkids when they're sitting in their lap. So sometimes we simulate what a vision loss is for the family members so that they can get a better understanding of what this means to have macular degeneration or to have had a visual stroke and not be able to see things to the right or the left. Coaches often have more questions than the patients do begin with. They might ask questions like, gee, I'm really interested, tell me more about the disease, or I think Grandma could use this kind of equipment, so let's be her coach, her cheerleader, to help her learn what she needs to know. I always remind coaches I can't go home with them at the end of the night and encourage them to take our phone numbers so that if they have questions or the patient has questions, they have their own team of support and they're able to call us with any kind of question at any time of the day.
Thank you, Leah. There are some traits that we've talked about culpability here a lot, and that is the characteristics that a person has themselves for making changes and getting involved with low vision process, and that is what we need for success, I believe, as well. What are the traits and characteristics or abilities needed in a person with vision loss, in your opinion, to successfully participate in a low vision program such as you're describing?
Oh, good question, Dan. The traits that a person needs to have or be willing to acquire. One, when we interview people, they have to, it sounds strange, but I really want to look at how much do they understand. Are they able to gain new knowledge? Do they have any other types of disabilities that are going to compromise their success with or complicate their success with vision rehabilitation? They've got to be willing to try, willing to make changes. Sometimes we have to find out, again, if they have any cognitive processing issues. A lot of our patients are elderly, and we're dealing with many people who have dual diagnosis of vision and hearing, or vision and memory loss, or dementia, other things like that. So a person's got to want to be willing to work at rehabilitation. They need to be willing to, like I said, to learn a little bit and to be a little bit flexible. Now, we can teach flexibility to some extent, but if I've got a very, very rigid type A person and that's the way they've been for 80 years and they've always had an executive secretary, it gets harder to say you're going to need to start learning a new strategy and making adjustments. Sometimes it's important to have a sense of humor. If you can't laugh at the fact that when you went through the buffet aisle and you were making a hamburger, you accidentally put the brownie with the mustard and the ketchup, you're going to have a harder time. So, and you've got to be also willing to act almost willing to fail, willing to try to be successful, dare to be great kind of things. But the most common characteristics are having the functional capabilities. So in other words, the ability to learn, the ability to remember, the ability to process information, and a little bit of willingness to work are the key factors that I find are really beneficial to coping.
I think, Dan, too, after hearing what Leah just said, which I totally agree with, let's talk about Leah with maybe the title of Don't Worry About, okay? Don't worry about if you have enough money. I think a lot of times people are so worried about that. It's not that there aren't financial issues. You have to pay to go through the low vision program, and certainly you've got to pay to get these devices. Now, sometimes you can work with different groups where they can help find funding, and you simply have to say to yourself, look, if that's what I need to do, that's what I need to do. I think a person that's been giving all of their life, that's sometimes very hard to accept or to move in that direction. But I would say two things. You have to move in that direction so you can get back to the direction you enjoyed going before. And also remember how good it made you feel when you were able to help or do something for someone else. So I think having that sort of attitude. I think, too, don't worry about some of the fears that you might have. I think you'll probably find out going through the low vision rehabilitation process that there's many more things that you can grow and gain from than fall back on. I think that it's one of these deals where you just got to stick your toes into the water. Hopefully, it's something you want to do, but I'm just saying, don't be afraid. I think another thing, too, is don't worry about making these types of mistakes. Like Leah said, we see people all the time that are afraid because when they eat, they might not be able to eat as well at first as they did before, or they might make the wrong choices, and on, but I'm just saying the only way you're going to get better is if you stick with it and try. And there is such a warm feeling I think our staff gets when we do indeed see a person that is the unsinkable Molly Brown, that has a good sense of humor, and is the type of person that just says to themselves, you know, I'm still here, so I'm going to get better. So come on in. And plus, one last thing I would say is we do have patients we feel are dragged in here by the coaches, so to speak. Maybe the person doesn't want to be here, but the loved one just can't stand watching what's going on and the suffering and just feels that, you know, I just have to have it happen. Well, sometimes that vision isn't so good for our staff, that the person just is like stubborn and doesn't want to do anything. But number one, I think then the coach does gain something. They see exactly what the opportunities are, and certainly our door is always left open. And I would tell you that one trait of the professional staff should be that they have a sense of humor and thick skin. I'll turn it back to you, Dan.
Okay, I know there are a lot of people out there nodding their heads. They probably are recognizing themselves in the descriptions of some of the types of patients that you see. I do think the sense of humor is probably one of the most important things, and that's kind of the focus of our newsletter this month. It's just full of stories that people have sent in about the funny things that have happened to them because of their low vision, and it helps us to all share in our each other's foibles, as I put it. Let's move on to your secrets now. We have professionals that watch these webcasts, and they learn from these too. There's probably a few people out there who are in the business of low vision, and they would probably like to hear what you might have to say next year. What are the secrets to your success in working with the thousands of people that you have worked with in vision loss?
Well, I think, Dan, we were very, very blessed that it's hard to figure out your destiny in a way, or why good things happen. I mean, I think Leah and I feel that there's an angel flying over us all the time. But I'll share with you that I think some of the same attitudes we talked about before, I think they must come and must be demonstrated in your staff, which means you have to be patient. You have to be compassionate. You have to want to help. You have to be humble. You better have thick skin at times. You better be able to see potential in people as well. I don't know that there, you know, as far as models go, I know it's very difficult to get a model like ours going. We've been very fortunate. We've had a very good non-for-profit structure. We have a good board. We've been very, very fortunate that the people that work here are very gifted. And like a world championship team, we've been pretty lucky that we sort of have a family structure and very good chemistry. I also can share with you that we have pretty much an open-door philosophy here. I don't think any of us feel that our gifts are any more important than the next person's gifts. And simply said, I mean, there's some days I'll have bad days, and, you know, I have to count on Leah or Connie Ahrens or some of the rest of my staff to bail me out, you know, and hope for the next visit that I can do a much better job, you know. So I think it's that wonderful teamwork. And then if you're so lucky to have a physical plant or a setting, we've enjoyed having a house instead of a clinic. We actually had the good grace in 2002 of having a successful campaign, and we built the inside of our house so it would be like a working environment and also a friendly environment as well. So we have many examples in here, lighting, contrast, talking devices, and so it just makes a wonderful place, I think. Even the sidewalks that you walk up to, as I look out at the snow here, we don't have to shovel our sidewalks leading into our facility because we have heating coils in our sidewalks. Leah, I'm going to have you add to this. What do you think are some of the secrets to our success here?
Okay. I think one of the major secrets to our success is that we will spend the time with a person, as much time as they need, that we listen, that we laugh with them. Sometimes we cry with them. We understand that when a person comes here, they're hurting. They're hurting functionally. Sometimes they're hurting emotionally and psychologically. And if they're angry or they're frustrated, it's not necessarily at us. Dr. Williams talked about a thick skin. We need a thick skin, but we need a big heart. And I think that's an important part about your staff and your agency, is that you need to understand that these people, if they're angry, they're not angry at you. That they're angry at their situation. We also try and help people find a place to land. And by that I mean sometimes people march in the door going, I got to drive a car. I have to have car keys. And we try and help them before we close that door that we may have to close to say you don't have the vision to. We try and open the door of hope that, you know, there's ADA paratransit, there's Dial-A-Ride, there's all of these services that mean that you don't always have to ask your spouse. So we try and open as many doors as we possibly can. And again, if we have a patient who doesn't want to participate, maybe they're doing it for a psychological reason. They're afraid that if they get too independent, their son might not come around on Saturdays and do the mail with them, and their daughter might not come by and help them with the grocery shopping, and their grandkids might not visit so often because they aren't needed to read stories to or something like that. So we always try and help people land in a safe space, I guess is the words I'd use, no matter how their outcome is functionally. We want to give them enough information and enough emotional and psychological support to help them move forward in their journey. Thank you.
Excellent. I hope a lot of people are listening to this and are going to try to follow this. You two are being very humble, but a lot of this has to do with your own personalities. This cannot work everywhere. It takes a special kind of professional to be able to do what you're doing there at the Spectrios Institute. I've been there. I've seen it. I felt the atmosphere of the place, and I don't know why anybody wouldn't succeed in an atmosphere like that. So, like I say, I hope that you are going to become a model to more and more of the low vision institutes around the country. I have a final question for you. As far as the future goes, what are some of the big challenges that lie ahead for people like us with vision loss, and what are some of the big opportunities that we have to look forward to?
Well, I think one of the big challenges, of course, is we're still struggling, even in the United States, to recognize that there are a significant group of people out there that have vision loss, and that there are no cures yet for many of these types of vision losses. And when there are no cures, the next best word, I think, is improvement. And that's why I think it's so critical that we've got to get our eye doctors and the rest of the medical community embraced on the fact that the continuum of eye care for people with vision loss is low vision rehabilitation. If there's no useful vision, then it's blind rehabilitation. We must understand that people must get the opportunity, one, to be aware of these facts and have access to these types of services. I think another thing is we must get the government to understand that just like eye surgery or drug eye therapy, that low vision rehabilitation and blind rehab, these are treatment modalities. They are very important. I think we are going to see more people, if they're so fortunate to live a long life. At this point, they're very prone to having some form of a vision loss. So what do we do about that? Do we just throw our hands up in the air and say, well, we'll just wait for those cures? I think people need the opportunity to act on this type of challenge today. And so that's why I think it's so important for your work, Dan, and I think even people as they go through the low vision process to spread the word. We found that over 60% of the people that come in to see us were referred by consumers. Now, what's wrong with that picture? So, and I think when the struggles we have with our health system, with Medicare only paying for glasses after cataract extraction or prosthetic eyes, when you see a study like you and I saw, Dan, Prevent Blindness's study, Dr. Frick at Johns Hopkins a few years back, that demonstrated clearly that the economic burden to society right now because of vision loss is $51.4 billion. Now, come on. I mean, we have to have more attention to this issue. But I think some of the big opportunities are there's a lot of grassroots awareness and access to going on. I do think that people get it. It's just it perhaps needs to be marketed a little stronger, or maybe in the educational process, just a a few more board questions on low vision rehabilitation. But I really think what's going on is there are a lot of research projects going on, so more evidence-based. I think what you're beginning to see is you're seeing people out there that are staying employed. You're seeing people that are staying out of assisted living when they don't have to be in there. And I just think overall hope. I think hope supported by science is truly a real issue right now that we can look forward to. And by the way, as far as cure goes, I do think that there are going to be some cures. I think stem cell and synthetic parts, there's great things. But sometimes they're not absolute cures. What they do is they make people better low vision patients. And I think some of the electronic stuff that Leah's talked about, oh my gosh, there's so many gee whiz things out there that are the prices are going to drop. And I just think it's going to be more and more can do. But you've got to be engaged. You've got to get into the mainstream. Leah, why don't you add to that?
Okay. The challenges, if you look at the aging population curves and statistics, we are getting older. The boomer generation is going to be, you know, moving up into that category of quote, elderly. And they are a demanding group. We want to stay engaged. Getting there sooner or later. I want to be able to do all the things I used to do. I don't want to be a rocking chair retired grandma. So we as baby boomers are seeking to stay involved, and that's an opportunity. A challenge, but it's also an opportunity. As we are a demanding group, we're asking mainstream technology to say, "Hey, think about us. Think about us." And with people doing more, quote, even the younger kids doing more multitasking, their technology is becoming more and more accessible because they're trying to do six things at once, not because they can't see the screen. So we're getting talking GPS, which are helping people be safe on the road. There's talking pedestrian GPS that's coming out or has been out and getting better. Looking at over-the-counter computer technology. Look at the iPad. It is accessible. It's got magnification. It's got screen reading. It's got voice recognition. So over the counter, we're getting more and more tools that enable us to stay engaged and stay involved. And I think that's going to be the opportunities as technology keeps rolling forward, that with the baby boomers getting older, they're going to be looking at making things universally accessible. Thanks, Dan.
Okay, that does bring us to the end of my questions, and I do want to give you a chance to kind of wrap things up here. You've said it all. I have nothing to add to what you've said there. We're going to let you go ahead and have your final words there, and then we'll see if there are any questions from the audience. We just have a few minutes left, so let's try to wrap this up now and see what we might hear from our audience. And so I'll be turning that over to Dr. Huggett, but just a couple more comments. Anything that you want to wrap up with there? I want to thank you both, Dr. Williams and Leah, for coming in, Leah Gerlach, for coming in today and spending this time with us. I think you've given us a lot to think about, and this is going to be a session that's going to have to be listened to more than once, I think. Dr. Williams?
Dan, I you know, the one thing I'd just say is that if you have vision loss, I think you can do better. And it's just like me, when I look in the mirror every day, I'd have to say I can do better too. Keep on trying to work with fine groups like yours, Dan, and find out, you know, where you can go or what you can do, what you can listen to. I think there's some very exciting things going on, and just encourage people never to give up. Leah?
All I want to say is that you're not alone. There are lots and lots of people with vision loss. Find a friend. Find a support group. Ask questions. You will be surprised how much is beyond that door, if you grab the handle and you open it up into the possibilities of vision rehabilitation, and getting to know that you're not alone and there's lots of people out there who are journeying with you, who can help you to be the best that you can possibly be. Thank you.
Well, this is going to be a voice from the front row seat here. This is Dr. Ed Huggett, optometrist, and I just wanted to say hello to Dr. Williams and Ms. Gerlach. Thank you so much. I've been sitting here just really enjoying the presentation. Thank you so very much. I will definitely be watching this again a few more times. But while I'm speaking here, we have a few more minutes to just have some questions submitted. And we do have one question there, and if there's another one or two, we've got a minute, we can go ahead and address those. So if you don't mind, Dr. Williams or Ms. Gerlach, if you want to pitch in here and just pick who wants to answer the first question here. And that first question is, how do we find rehabilitation centers? And that's from Joan in Sun City.
One way is there is a group called NAC. It's the National Accreditation Council for Agencies Serving the Visually Impaired and Blind. And I happen to be on that board right now. Their home office is in Cleveland, and they accredit about 60 agencies throughout the United States. And I think they're well aware of many of the agencies out there. But again, if you wanted to Google NAC, N-A-C, I think you can get in touch with them. You can as well get in touch with the American Optometric Association. You might be able to Google the AOA Low Vision Rehabilitation Section. I think the phone number there is 1-800-365-2219. Again, they have a low vision section, and they know where low vision doctors are at. I can tell you the Academy of Ophthalmology also has a vision rehabilitation section. Again, I think in states, you can get in touch with either the Optometric or Ophthalmological Association and just ask about low vision, and I think you can get some direction there. And we shouldn't forget about our friends at AER. That's the Association of Educators and Rehabilitation Professionals. Whoa, that's a mouthful. And also the AOTA, the Occupational Therapist. Leah, do you want to add to that at all?
There's one wonderful website called the American Foundation for the Blind. You go to their link on Directory of Services for People with Vision Loss. You put in your state. You can pull down any particular kind of service, whether it's a radio reading services, whether you're looking for low vision services, whether you're looking for in-home training or computer training or mobility training or guide dogs, and it will tell you what's available in your state. So that's AFB.org and link on directory of services. It's constantly being updated, and it will even get you those optometric associations and departments of ophthalmology.
Very good. Thank you. And Dan just posted many of these resources can also be found at the website, www.mdsupport.org/resources.html. Just go to the mdsupport.org website, and some of those things can be found also. Joan also had one other question. Is Society for the Blind considered a rehab center?
I'm not quite sure when you say Society for the Blind. Yeah, where it is. I think that if you were to look and see what their staff was, their staff consisted of, and what the credentials were, we really like to see that a center or an institution does have the professionals with the credentials. So that's why we like to see that there is an optometrist or an ophthalmologist who's trained in the low vision field. We like to see rehabilitation teachers and occupational therapists. We do like to see rehabilitation counselors, social workers, adaptive and assistive technology people, O&M specialists. So you can see there's a pretty big scorecard here. There can be fewer people involved, but if it's of a prescriptive nature, you like to see that there's a doctor component in it.
Well, all good things have to come to an end, and I'm sorry to say that that's the case today. So I want to personally thank Dr. Tracy Williams and Ms. Leah Gerlach. Thank you so much for being a part of our presentation today, and I know this will go down into probably one of the top 10 for sure in our archives here. So thank you so much. We've got this in the can, and I look so much and so forward to our presentation next month, and we've put up a slide here on Dr. Williams and Ms. Gerlach and how you can get a hold of them and what they've done for the community of low vision. And Dan, I'm going to turn it back over to you, and I'm going to sign off and say keep looking up, and thank you so much. Back to you, Dan.
Thank you, Dr. Ed. Next month we are going to be welcoming Maurice Perret from the Blind Industries and Services of Maryland. He was on the team that scaled Mount Everest. He is a blind man himself, and he's going to give us some stories about that, and we're going to discuss the challenges low vision people face in crossing that bridge that Dr. Williams talked about a minute ago from visual and non-visual activities of daily living. So Dr. Huggett and I wish you another year of good health and good vision. Take care of yourselves. Thank you again, Dr. Williams and Leah Gerlach, for joining us today, and we'll see everybody again in February.